My name is Jay, and I have Joe here with me, who's a dev lead for the client libraries. And we will be presenting Windows Azure Storage, in particular concentrating on how to build scalable applications using Windows Azure Storage. So this is a 400-level talk, and because of which the introduction is going to be to the minimum. So we are assuming everybody knows what Windows Azure Storage is, and I'm just going to briefly describe what it is in terms of the abstractions. Moving on, I will be talking about our scalability targets, our new scalability targets that we will soon have a blog post on. And then going on to best practices that will allow you to build scalable applications, best practices that will allow you to reduce your costs when building applications against storage. So these are some of the things that we will cover. And then we wanted to show those best practices in action. And so Joe has a great demo out here on how to build a scalable application. So he has this application that he'll go over, and then we'll take questions. So this is going to be kind of, it might take a full hour, and so we will just try to take the questions at the end, and I'll be out here at the booth and at the, whatever they call it, the zone where you're supposed to walk up and take questions. So I will surely be there. So introduction. What is Windows Azure Storage as such? It's a cloud storage system, and we provide various abstractions for these for Windows Azure Storage, which is blobs. You can think of blobs as where you start storing your files, and you can associate metadata with those files. Then we have queues. Queues is meant for asynchronous messaging. Almost in every scale scenario, you do not want your two components to be tightly coupled. You want to decouple them. And the way you do that is asynchronous messaging, which Q enables that. Tables, it's a NoSQL structured storage system that scales, that auto-scales so that you can build your application. You still have control on how your schema looks from your client aspect, but it's a NoSQL schema-less store from the service aspect. And then, of course, we have drives and disks. So these are network-mounted durable drives, which can now be useful to move your legacy applications to Windows Azure, running in the compute in Windows Azure. And so you will have these durable mounted drives, disks and drives, available to your applications that would have just used your NTFS APIs maybe. So it's a cloud storage system. Great. So what does that mean? A, it means it uses a pay-for-what-you-use model. Right? Conventionally, you had to go through this planning, and you start to pay right from that planning onwards, where you think about your peak traffic and you think about your peak transactions throughput, and then build your system for that. And you would have to start planning even before you hit the peak traffic. And what if your peaks are not, are kind of annually, it happens once in a year, maybe during Christmas time. What if you're building an application of that sort? You would have to pay upfront for all the hardware and things like that in a conventional system a few years back. With the cloud storage system, you can use it, and you pay for what you use. So when you scale, you start paying for the scale that you're using at, and then you can scale down all your applications when you don't need them, and so it reduces your costs. We are a durable system. By that, we mean that we store multiple copies of your data. These multiple replicas, there are two levels of these replicas. One is local redundant storage, which is local replication. And this is, you can think of every write that comes to our system is locally replicated to multiple nodes. And so now this is done in line with your transaction. Only once it's successful to write all these multiple copies would we return a success back to you. And then we have the geo-replication, which is done asynchronously, right? So once the local replication is done, we return back success, and then we pipeline this for it to be geo-replicated to a data center which is 400-plus miles apart. We are highly available because these multiple replicas are placed in such a way that they can withstand some common failures. Well, we have something called the upgrade domain and fault domains. Upgrade domains are how we roll out. So we don't get, So we roll out upgrade domain by upgrade domain, and then we have the fault domain, which you can think of as a rack. So a single rack would be a fault domain, for example, right? And so we spread these replicas across these so that common failures, like network failures, can be tolerated as such. And we are scalable because we have an auto load balancing scenario where with your traffic, we understand your traffic and then automatically load balance. So you don't need a DBA to sit and figure out what your hotspots are and then move your data around. We do that for you by load balancing these partition ranges. We use a partition range scheme, and we automatically load balance these partitions to meet your traffic demands. And we believe that most applications require strong consistency. If your fundamental layer provides you eventual consistency, it's very difficult to build applications that require strong consistency on them. So we went with the best practice of, let's provide strong consistency, and if users want eventual consistency, they can always build on top of it, right? And so our fundamental layer is always strongly consistent. Once you write and we return a success to you, you will always get that data back on your read. The other characteristics which is really crucial is that all these abstractions are backed by the same store. It's the same backend. And the reason why this is crucial is, A, it gives you the same set of features across all the abstractions. So you will get geo, you'll get a durability, strong consistency, it scales to meet your traffic demands, monitoring, partitioning system, all this, these characteristics, the fundamental characteristics that makes this usable in cloud is available across all abstractions. In addition, what it allows us to do is blend these traffic on our backends so that we can blend the, for example, blob and maybe, which is more IO bound, with maybe tables, which are more CPU bound, right? So we can blend these traffics in our servers to kind of reduce costs for running this service for us. And so that is one of the main reasons why we can give you why we can give you a cloud storage system at a cheaper cost. At peak, we do about 880,000 requests per second, and we have about 4+ trillion objects in our store. So just to mention that this is a scalable system, these are the stats that we have that we've shared a few months back. So what we provide is great performance at low transaction costs. We provided the way to access the cloud storage system, we provided an easy-to-use REST interface. And we know how much everybody loves writing REST APIs to the cloud. So for those who don't like it, the minority people, we always have a storage client library. So we found that the storage client library is something that people generally want to use. And it's something which we feel that should be language agnostic, because cloud is language agnostic. So we've provided these client libraries in various languages. You have Java, Node.js, PHP, .NET. And coming to client libraries, I don't know how many of you have looked at our 2.0 client library. The demo uses 2.0 today, and it'll cover a lot of awesome features. But one of the main reasons why you should move to cloud, to the 2.0 client library, is because of performance. And we will go over some of the performance improvements that we've had. It's amazing performance improvements, and we'll continue to add in these performance improvements out there. Of course, there are other tidbits out there, like asynchronous copy blob that you can use because of the new client library uses the February 2012 REST version. So how is Windows Azure Storage used internally at Microsoft? So we have various users. For example, we have Xbox that uses blobs, tables, and queues. They're all into Azure Storage, where they're using Azure Storage for their applications like Cloud Game Save, Halo Multiplayer application, Xbox Music, which was released recently, and Kinect Data Collection. So all these guys, that they need to scale, and they are using Windows Azure Storage to meet that scale demands rather than using conventional systems. SkyDrive, for example, is using Windows Azure Blobs to store your pictures and documents. Everybody hopefully knows what a SkyDrive is. You have your Windows RT tablets to play with, and that syncs up with basically SkyDrive. You have Bing, which is using this, which is using, again, Azure Tables, Queues, and Blobs to implement their ingestion engine that makes public status feeds from Facebook and Twitter, this fire hose of status updates that come in, to make that available to your Bing search engine. And so they are using, again, the scalable cloud storage system to achieve that. Just to get into the case study of how the Bing ingestion engine works, so you have your Facebook and Twitter status updates, and those status updates that come in need to be available to the Bing search engine within 15 seconds of its update. So this is their kind of, this was their goal that we're going with, right? So this fire hose of status updates, and everybody knows how frequently you have public status updates on Facebook or Twitter, and so all this should be available within 15 seconds of update. What they do is start coalescing all these updates into Windows Azure Blobs, and so they store all these into Blobs. So they batch this literally, right, all these status updates. And then it goes through this ingestion engine where they use Windows Azure Tables for indexing and Windows Azure Queues for this workflow process, because they have this ingestion engine which does annotation, ranking, content classification, and all that ingestion engine that they have, these workflow steps that they have. They use queues to kind of pipeline them together. And once it goes through the ingestion engine, the final results are stored into Blob, which is then made available to your Bing search engine. And so this is how they build the scalable applications, which can take both Facebook and Twitter, not just Facebook or Twitter, Facebook and Twitter. They take these status updates and make it available within 15 seconds. So this is the scale that they've built with. At peak, they do about 40,000 requests per second. They have about 2 to 3 billion requests per day. What's best about Azure Storage is their open REST APIs and the client libraries. Together, what they've done is there was this one developer who built this application as a hobby in 2 months' time. And this was not even his full-time job. And so that's how easy it is to start building your applications. There are a few best practices that you need to know about. And once you know that, you can start developing your applications and keep these cheat sheet of best practices with you to kind of get that scale. We have data centers all around, and so what we call as regions. So you have the North America region, Europe region, and Asia Pacific. Within North America, we have our 4 sub-regions. You have US West, East, South, and North. Then you have your Europe region out there and your Asia Pacific region. So you have all these regions where you can select where you want your storage account to be located. Generally, you choose a region based on where your customers, your end customers are, or where your application users are. In addition, we have CDN locations in multiple places that you can use to kind of serve these blobs that you have to basically people spread across the geography. And so you can use CDN to do that very efficiently, which works very well with Windows Azure Blobs. It's just go to the portal and then enable it. You get a URL, you start using that URL. Getting into scalability targets. Hopefully, most of you have read our blogs on scalability targets. We're pleased to announce certain changes in those scalability targets. And we'll have a blog out here that kind of goes through it. But one of the reasons, we wanted to just cover what is the reason for increasing these scalability targets or improving these scalability targets as such. We've gone with flat network storage design. So we had this hierarchical network before. And now we've gone with this flat network storage design, which we call as Q10 network or Quantum 10 network, which gives us basically 10 G of fully meshed network available to your applications. And the other change that we've done is move to a software load balancer. So all these changes in our network and in our hardware, from moving from a hardware load balancer to a software load balancer, has allowed us to kind of up the scalability targets. because this data center now provides in excess of 50 terabits per second for the data center as such. So this is one of the reasons why we can move the scalability targets up more. And there'll be a detailed blog post on this by Brad Calder very soon. This was needed because of high bandwidth scenarios, right? Everybody knows about our IIS release by now. And IIS basically uses Windows Azure Disk, which is from your compute, it needs to now write to page blobs, right? And IIS Disk, HPC, MapReduce applications like Hadoop, all these have kind of forced us to look at our network design, has forced us to look at our hardware, and we've upped it now to meet these demands, to meet this big data transport between compute and storage. So the new scalability targets, these will be public by end of 2012, will be applied only to storage accounts that have been created after June 7th. The reason is, again, because these accounts are on the Q10, are on the clusters or stamps, which are Q10 network. And that is one of the reasons why this was one of the prerequisites for upping the scalability targets. The capacity has been increased to 200 terabytes. The transaction rate for an account has been increased to 20,000 entities messages per second, or blobs per second. The bandwidth, now there are two levels. If you've chosen geo-redundant, geo-replication basically for your storage account, then you get an ingress up to 5 gig and egress up to 10 gig. So this is what you will get if you've chosen geo-replication. If you've chosen local redundant, which you may do if the data can be reproduced on a geo disaster or something of that sort, if the data center goes down, if you can reproduce this data, like logging data or MapReduce data and things, Hadoop data kind of thing, where you can reproduce this data if the data center, if there's a data center failover, then you could choose local redundancy, or you may choose local redundancy because of reasons where you do not want your replication to go outside a boundary of a country or something of that sort, because in Europe it's between Amsterdam and Dublin, and in Asia it's Hong Kong and Singapore. So maybe there are reasons, compliance reasons, where you do not want the data to move outside of the country and things like that. So you could choose locally redundant storage. If you do so, then you get an ingress up to 10 gig and egress up to 15 gig. So these are the changes done at a storage account level. And then at a partition level, again, these targets will be public by end of 2012 and applied to accounts created after June 7th, 2012. A single Q, which is account name plus Q name, is your partition, right? A single Q can now do 2,000 messages per second. A single table partition, a partition for table is account name, table name, and the partition key value. And it can do up to 2K, again, entities per second. And a single blob, which is account name, container name, and the blob name, a combination, concatenation of all these three, you can get up to 60 megabits per second. So this is our scalability, new scalability target that we will be announcing soon. Moving over to best practices, we kept mentioning Windows Azure Storage has been built for scale. So how do you build applications that actually scale when using Windows Azure Storage? What are the best practices? I want to cover some of the common settings that you use first, and which we've actually looked at analytics with users and figured out, oh yeah, these common settings would help you a lot. One is turn off Nagling and Expect 100. That increases your throughput considerably, especially for smaller messages or entities. Nagling really would help you when you're trying to store your data. Increase your connection limit. By default, the connection limit is 2, and almost every time that people come to us saying, hey, I'm not getting the advertised throughput, it's been one of these reasons. And so increase your connection limit, and this needs to be done before you create your first service point in .NET, right? So you need to increase. The best thing to do is put this either in your config or put this as a first line in your application so that it's applied once it starts. And we've seen numerous, it's not even funny anymore. We've seen numerous accounts where the connection limit keeps biting us, where users don't get enough throughput. Turn off proxy detection, especially when you're running in the cloud. This adds a lot of overhead. Even if you're not communicating with Windows Azure Storage itself, do this because this adds a lot of overhead for your initial setup, service point setup. The next thing is, it's kind of generic, right? Design your application that avoids hotspots. It's easier said than done. So we will go through each one of the abstractions and see how you can do that. But this is one of the things that you need to look at. When you have your application, when you know your user request patterns, design your application so that it'll avoid these hotspots. So your partitions that you select, your partition key value for your tables, or your blob names, or queues, you will be designing so that you will not have any hotspots as such. So one of the things that would help is if you avoid append and prepend pattern. In any range-based partitioning system, any range-based, append and prepend patterns, which are basically your request pattern follows this lexical sorting of the keys, right? So your access pattern is just this lexical sort order. It's not good because in a range-based partitioning system, it'll always go to the last range because you're always appending. So it'll go to this last range of the partition, which is served by one server. So you're getting a throughput of one server, which is a waste. By the way, append and prepend patterns should be avoided for scale reasons. If you come back and say, hey, I need 10 requests every hour, yeah, fine. Append prepend pattern is not going to be your bottleneck out there, right? And so you'll need to judge whether it's a scale scenario or not, and then have this append prepend pattern. You'll have to avoid append prepend patterns for scale. One-time operations, and Joe is going to go over in his code too. One-time operations, do that once, not on every operation, right? Whenever a user request comes in, you don't have to create a container for him. You can do it once when he signs up for your service, for example. And so setting ACLs and things like that, which is one time, do that in an initialization phase rather than every request that you process. Because these are requests at the end of it, and these requests, even if it's a few milliseconds, would add up when you have millions of users hitting your application. Turn on analytics and take control of your investigations. You do not need anybody else to help you with your investigations because you have complete information at your fingertips. The thing which you can do out here with logging and metrics is, for example, who deleted my container, right? That, you can go to your logs, figure out your IP address. And Joe is going to go through more of these, but why is my request latency so high? So you can go and look at your log again or metrics and see if it is end-to-end latency, which is more than the server latency. Server latency is how much storage has spent processing your request. End-to-end latency involves the round trip plus any overheads on your client before you send us back an ACK for that request. So all this stuff, all these kind of scenarios, which are very, very common when you build your application, especially your distributed application, can be solved using analytics. Use appropriate retry policies for intermittent errors. We have a default exponential backoff. You can change it. There are various ways. And the 2.0 client library has this awesome way of writing retry policies. No delegates to a delegate, and just headaches. It's just a class that you need to derive from, and that's your retry policy. So it's very simple, and Joe will go over it. Storage accounts. Co-locate your storage accounts with your compute roles because egress is free, so that's kind of obvious. You would always want to be as close as possible to your storage account. Use multiple storage accounts to either achieve targets that exceed a single storage account or because of client proximity. So if you are targeting, let's say, Asia and North America, you might want a storage account in each one of these with your clients located in the appropriate stamps or regions. And map multiple clients to the same storage account. You do not have to create a storage account for each one of your customers, right? You can map it, map multiple one of them either by using containers or space them by using paths to blobs. If you're storing blobs, you can space them that way, or partition key values. You can either use multiple containers if you're doing something like SAS ACLing, or you can store them in one container. Either ways will work, but you don't need a separate storage account for each one of them. So with storage accounts, again, I said multiple storage accounts. So one of the things that you have to consider is if my application really becomes famous tomorrow, how do I scale, right? And to that, you'll have to start thinking about how do I add more storage accounts? How do I distribute it? Maybe new users go to this new storage account and I have a lookup based, or I have a consistent hashing method to figure out where this user is. Any one of those two methods work. With consistent hashing, you also need a way to migrate portion of your data to your new location. With lookup based, you don't have that headache because you can retain that user there and have multiple containers or something of that sort and other stamps to start storing more data. So there are various scenarios out there solutions out there that you can use to kind of scale. Use different account for Windows Azure Diagnostics. Diagnostics, unfortunately, today uses append-only pattern, and some people have more diagnostics than requests per second, and so it'll be nice to actually use a separate storage account. And I'm not saying that you don't need diagnostics, I'm just saying use a separate storage account so that you can diagnose your applications, at the same time not have your diagnostic pipeline impact your production account. Choose local redundant storage, and I've already covered this. If the data can be restored, usually Hadoop kind of applications, that's the scenario where you already have your data out there, so you can just turn off geo-replication for such accounts. For blobs, there are two common things that we keep getting asked. One, how can I upload a single blob? How can I upload it as fast as possible, which is basically latency, right? It's a latency-related problem. Use parallel upload. You have block blobs. You can upload all these blocks in parallel. That gives you more throughput, it reduces the latency because you're uploading these parallel blocks, and that's the fastest way you can upload it. Storage Client Library has methods to do that. The second question we ask is, I have this container full of blobs. How do I upload this, all these blobs, the fastest, which is now throughput? Out here, you don't have to now use multiple parallel uploads for each blob. What you can do is you parallelize the uploads of individual blobs, and you can select these blobs to upload all the blobs together to start uploading them in parallel, or rather pipeline them. One of the future service updates that we will do is for your blob writes, we will be resolving the append prepend pattern problem for blob writes, so that you can think of copying a container. The normal way is list all your files and start uploading. This is lexically sorted. Your partition key is the blob name, and now it's an append pattern. If you're trying to get high scale, it's following append pattern, which does not allow you high scale. And we will be resolving that in a future service update very soon. How to migrate or backup blobs. Now you have asynchronous copy. Take your storage account, pipeline all your copies, and then just wait for the magic to happen. So you can start polling your these requests, and once it's completed, you migrate to your account or copied your backed up your blobs. In partial read scenarios, where you want to read only portion of your data and it's small chunks, write smaller chunks. You can write 64 KB chunks, for example, and then start reading these smaller chunks rather than writing a block of 4 MB and then reading smaller chunks. It's more efficient to do to kind of write the size that you're going to be reading. Table design and scalability. It's a NoSQL store, and I don't think NoSQL store is as mature enough in terms of best practices and design, how to design. You have various books for a relational store, but for a NoSQL store, it's usually how do you design this, and it's application-based, right? What is your major scenarios? The questions that you need to answer are, what are my critical queries? And that'll give you your partition key and row key, and then keep thinking about how do I avoid hotspots. batch processing, what if I need some transactional capabilities? Since we provide just a single index and a batch processing or batch transaction is on a single partition key value, that will drive, again, your design of your table. It's schema-less, so take advantage of this, the fact that it's schema-less. You can store multiple types for co-location, and Joe's demo also has a scenario where he's doing this. Single index, we provide you a single index so you can start concatenating various properties that you need so that it can be pivoted in the right fashion. Entity locality, that's, again, one of the things that Joe will be talking about. Think in terms of when I retrieve this data, and if my read scenario is what is critical, how do I have this entity locality so I can get all these results as fast as possible? So storing related entities together will reduce the I/O needed on the back end and also improve your performance. Avoid large number of scans, and Joe's application needed a lot of scans, and we've gone with a design that reduced scans, and so that'll be very helpful. You would, the thing to consider when you're designing your table application is the scan cost is not how many results am I getting back. It is how many entities would the server have to read to get your results back, right? So the selectivity of your query matters a lot. So that's the cost of your of querying or scanning. And so strive to have either a partition index that will reduce these scans, or a cross-partition level index, which is eventually consistent, that you can build to reduce these scans, or caching. And so Joe's going to go over some of it, where he's used caching to kind of reduce the scans. Low latency requirements, scans do not, if you have a low latency requirement and you're scanning, that would not hold well for your application, so you need to reduce the amount of scans that you do. The last tidbit is for your WCF data service client library, which is don't use the same data service context or table service context, which just derives from data service context, across threads. So each user request logical operation per se can get its own data service context or table service context. With respect to queue design and scalability, make message processing idempotent. Update message basically is used to kind of either save intermittent state or even extend your visibility time. So you can use that to do that and have shorter leases instead. Use message count to scale out your number of worker roles or processors. Use dequeue count to figure out if a message is a poison message or maybe your visibility time is too short, so you can do all these analysis on using your dequeue count. Batch get to improve your throughput, and use blobs to store messages when you want to batch or if your message size actually increases 64 kilobytes in size. So either one of these, you might store your message in the blob and then store the blob reference in the message, and that kind of increases your throughput. And I'm pretty sure a lot of our customers are already doing that, and we see it. It's really a novel idea to kind of increase your throughput. Use multiple scales when you have to scale above a single partition. A single partition queue can do 2,000 requests per second, but if you, messages per second, but if you need to do more, use multiple queues, and Joe again goes through it because his demo needed multiple queues to kind of scale out. Share access signature, use HTTPS to kind of give out your tokens, because once anybody gets a handle on your token, they can start accessing your blobs with the required permissions that you've given. Use minimum permissions. Clock skew is one of the problems that we've generally seen with shared access signatures, where the client has said, oh, let me start at 11 o'clock, and it's not exactly 11 o'clock. There's a clock skew between the server time and the client time. So whenever you renew your time or when you're giving, give sufficient leeway to your expiry or your start time. Revocable SAS, which is basically you store all the parameters in the container as an ACL, and then use that as the identifier for your shared access signature. Shared access signatures, by the way, I'm assuming everybody knows what it is. It's a pre-authenticated URL. And so we allow you to store 5 ACLs, and you can revoke the SAS again. With REST version 2012.02, we allow an expiry of greater than 1 hour. Before, we were kind of policing every shared access signature that was not using a container ACL. We've removed that policing. So you guys would be best to understand if you needed it or not. And sorry, Joe, took more time than I had to.
That's all right. All right. Yeah, my name is Joe. My team works on the client libraries that Jay was just talking about, so I have a demo here. Something important to know is best practice is huge in running scale apps, and something we've done is, to the best extent possible, is we've put all of that into the client libraries. So if you're concerned about latency, for example, there's a pre-built parallel upload right out of the box. All you have to do is configure what parallelism you want. There's a bunch of other things, retry policies, for example. If something happens, especially in mobile devices, everyone's writing apps for Windows 8 now, and we're excited with our 2.0 release that we're supporting more platforms. So we have .NET 4, but we've also released a Windows 8, Windows MD library, and a table extension library as well. And then Windows Phone is coming. So we have a clicker
here. Okay. There you go.
All right, so we have a scenario here. Again, thinking mobile apps, a couple things about mobile apps. I/O can be spotty sometimes, right? I lost my network connectivity, whatever. Again, built-in retry policies will absorb all of that for you out of the storage client, but it's up to you to decide for your application, what are my latency considerations, how many times do I want to retry, things like that. The other thing is we got a ton of feedback from previous SDKs that people want more hooks and more ability to do different things, and so we've opened up a lot more opportunities for you to have a lot more knowledge as to what's happening on your behalf over the wire, and also give you the ability to fine-tune a retry policy for pretty much any sort of failure. So this is our app. Now, when you're making a scale app, you may have seen on some tablets like a game where you draw with friends, things like that. That is easy for 5 users, for 10 users, for a few people, and it's very easy if you're not all playing at the same time. But what if I want to do something like that with 10 million users, right? What if I really want to scale? And so the app that we dreamed up here is effectively just a gigapixel wall, right? And if you've used big maps or if you think of deep zoom or anything like that, the idea being that everyone is on this huge wall. They don't necessarily know where everybody else is, but it's kind of a deep zoom scenario so that at any point I can see what the whole thing looks like, but I could do my little scribbles are here. So you can imagine, you know, homecoming or graduation, we all go and write or upload a picture. For our purposes, we're just letting you draw shapes, which is simple enough. So the goal here is to allow a single wall to be used by many, many users and to scale out. All right. So we'll flip over to the demo real quick. I'll just give you a quick example. And I am not a UI developer by trade, so don't judge me there. So we have a little app here. Am I connected?
Yeah, I think it did come on. No?
Just 1 second. There we go. All right. I accidentally published this to Dublin, which was adding
by
a little bit of latency.
Our geography is so good that we chose Dublin.
Yeah. So, all right. So I have a whole bunch of, I have a really simple lobby here. And just the background of these different walls. So I'm going to log in. Jay can log in. Other people can log in. And I have this app. You can imagine this is on my Windows RT device or phone or whatever. And I'm just going to go in here and draw a whole bunch of shapes. All right? And then I want to be able to zoom out. Again, the UI zooming isn't just right. But you can see what we're doing here is coalescing all of this massive data. And this is an image on the size of gigapixels when you go all the way up. Right? It's several thousand different little tiles and all these things put together. So what I want to be able to do, though, is let's see if I go to the same tile here. You can maybe see that other people are going to see the same things. There's different best practices that we're showing here. And so we'll jump into some code so you can see different things there. So you saw some shapes magically show up. I didn't animate them or everything. But
so we have a few of our colleagues sitting out back in a building out there where Azure Storage is being deployed, who are also playing with this game at the same time.
Yep. So let's jump back to the slides, and I'll just show you a couple high-level points that we did for this application. So if you want to build something like this, you have a few choices. Traditionally, your first choice would say, okay, I have a whole bunch of clients. I need a whole bunch of servers, and they all need to share the same data. So that's great. They'll have some sort of distributed cache or do it in memory. That's fine. But now I have to scale my compute with how many users I have at the same time. And that can be peaky. I have to deploy. I have to manage that, not to mention cost. A lot of social games and whatnot are either free or ad-supported, so cost is a factor here.
Actually, going back to this, this is what your option was before we had shared access signatures, right? Because you didn't want to give your secret key to the devices because they can go and party on your account or delete your data. So you didn't want that. And this was the this was one of the ways that people were developing applications. Now with shared access signatures, there are more options.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. People sometimes think, oh, well, I'll just store it in some local storage. You never want to give out your storage key. And this is where SAS comes in. Not only for that scenario, but also to give people very fine-grained
control
access.
Yeah.
And we've updated it. So now with SAS, and now earlier this year we announced it's supported for queues and tables as well, which is great. So now what I can do is I can move all my devices and say, you know what, don't go to the FE, go straight to storage. Now we have an issue there, how do they get the tokens? So the one service, we have a smaller service up here, is what we call the SAS provider model. So now you just stand up just a couple small nodes, some sort of service, and all they do all day long is auth and they issue tokens. And so now when you sign up or you join the wall and you want a list, all you do is come to me, and I give you a token. And I'll, for you specifically, I can give it for what you're doing. I can say, just for this hour, you're allowed to access this one partition key or this one row, or you can access this queue or this blob, et cetera. So that's great. Now, this works, but as Jay just talked about, let's assume we have this later account. We get 2,000 entities per second per partition. So that works to a point. And if you're under 2,000, you're done. Go straight to profit. Life is good. But if you need to go beyond that, we have to think a little bit more creatively here. And so for our scenario there, we had all these different tiles, and we consider that our partition, our unit of data. And the more you need to scale, we wrote it so that you could just make smaller tiles. And if someone wanted to publish this app, we could handle the boundary case of drawing over boundaries and things like that. That's fine. But we want everyone to see the same data. And right now, since they're accessing storage, they're just pulling. They're just pulling all the time. What's the data there? I need it to update on the screen. That won't scale when I issue this to 2 million people. 2 million scans, and that's the thing that we were talking about earlier. It's going to be very expensive. So the first thing that comes to mind there is some sort of caching. So now we're going to go to some more of a hybrid approach. Scans should be avoided, and obviously you can go over the scalability targets. All right, so this is the approach we took. So now we're going to write directly to storage, because everyone's writing in different places. They're all over these different tiles. And we have some edge cases where everyone's on the same. We can handle those as well. And those writes are coalesced. We're using kind of a lazy entity pump on the client side to batch all this stuff together and stick it in a table. So it's not every second or every millisecond, I write one entity, I write it. I write one entity, I write it. You can do that. And again, we're kind of, there's this different needle between your latency requirements and whatnot. That's up to you to design for your application. So for our scenario, we're writing straight to storage using that SAS key via the SAS provider. And then the graffiti service, so this guy has in-memory cache. Azure has a great distributed cache. You could use that. So now we can pull from them, and that's all in memory. So now what we've done is coalesce all these millions and millions of polling requests into just very few reads from storage. So this is already much better. My issue there is, what happens when this thing has been going for a very long time, and there's 10 million records for one tile, right? If I send 10 million records to any application, at the very least, it's not going to be fast and fluid. So we want to find some way, kind of like Hadoop, to give kind of a roll-up view of what this data is. Now, for our example, we're drawing shapes. And a shape, basically, what the client needs is something on their screen. So what we're going to do is just checkpoint. So periodically, when we get above a certain threshold, we're going to take all those shapes, render them in the cloud, write it, for our case, a PNG, and stick it back somewhere. So now, even if I have 10 million records, I have some checkpoint and just some deltas after that. And after some time, if I get too many, I just checkpoint again, squish it all back down. And now I can keep those polling cycles and actually the bandwidth to the client much, much lower and faster. So that's great. So this is where we're going to use queues here. And something important that we didn't show here is there's a couple different tables, and we'll get to that. The queue is great for guaranteed message delivery. Once you know I need this job processed, now with the two-phase delete, I can know, you know, maybe it's a poison message, I can recover. But no matter what, if my role dies or something happens, this message will be processed. So what we have here is we have some workers and a master. Technically, the great thing about being strongly consistent is that you can actually use storage abstractions as a lock. So now you can easily do master election just by trying to, you know, obtain a certain row and table or blob.
Can use a lease on a blob, for example, to elect your master as to who's going to do the checkpoint and things like that.
And this is great. For expedient's sake, we didn't do that in this case. But the major point there is fault resilience. If you have just one master role deployed and there's an upgrade or a fault, then the whole thing comes down. Yeah. If you have master election, now you have 20, 30, 40 workers, whatever it is. One guy goes down, the other guy pops up. So that's great. Devices are running directly to storage using SAS. There's no routing. Checkpoint workers coalesce these shapes. We talked about that. All right, so here's our data model. We have a master wall table. So when you first join, we want to see all the different games that are being played, right? You can think of this as, you know, on Xbox or anything else. You need to have some amount of games that we're going to list. So this is very, very simple. We just have, you know, basic configuration. What's the background color? What's the size of it? Things like that, the name. And then we have an individual wall table. Now, because a single wall can be gigapixels, even larger, can have a large amount of data, and we want to scale out, we selected to use one table. The other key thing here is that we put a unique ACL on this table itself. So now let's say, as opposed to having one table for all my data, somebody does something bad on one table. What I can do is go revoke just that policy on that one table, and all my other clients aren't affected. So that's great. The other cool thing we did here is we put the ACL with essentially no permissions on the table. It just is an identifier. So now what I can do is issue a whole bunch of different tokens with different start and end times or permissions based on that one policy to different users, but be able to revoke them all in some sort of logical grouping. So that's great. Partition key right now is our, it's actually Z, X, Y, but coordinates of the data. And the row key is just different things about the shape.
One of the things which I want to mention out there is append pattern. The master wall table, the service is creating walls, so it's not like every user is going to come and create a wall. Yep. The intention is to have more people on a single wall drawing on tiles and things like that in that wall, right? So that was our goal, if you remember initially. And so out here, the partition key has sticks, which is now you keep appending to the master wall table. It's fine for the scenario because the service is creating one wall every day or one wall every hour. So it just came.
And again, we are, because of reads, right, you could have several million people, we are caching this result on our front end server.
Yeah.
So when you go to, say, list my walls, it's already a pre-read thing that updates every 5 seconds or so. So you don't have that many scans, which is, you know, fine. And the last thing we have is a dirty table. We wanted the client to be able to tell the storage that this tile needs to be updated at some point, which is great. The problem is if I have 10 million people all touching the same data, I don't need to process it 10 million times. I just need to go get all the data once. So what we did is we just use an upsert or an insert or merge, and basically without specifying etag, there's a single entity and everybody can just party on the same one. And at the end of the day, when the master comes through, he sees one thing that he needs to schedule, and which is fine. For some scenarios, this is great. For others, yeah. Depends on your scenario.
So going back again, as I said, there were two options here, right? The device could have put a message in the queue saying, yes, I updated something. The problem with that is you'll have 10,000 messages from each of the 10,000 devices that may have updated the same tile. And you want the checkpoint to just be done once for it, not 10,000 times. So that's why we took the option of coalescing everything into one record per tile so that it goes and tells the dirty table, yes, this tile is dirty. And then the checkpoint would go and pull this and get it done. So there are two options. Sometimes it works. Sometimes the queue would work better if you actually have to process each one of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, another common pattern, we're using multiple different queues, is you could actually, the SaaS provider model, you could actually assign a queue to a given worker, right? So you're still using many queues, and you can scale those up and down. But as people join, you give them, point them to a different queue. That works as well. So a couple things here. With the 2.0 release, we have a few different ways to access tables. Specifically, there's something, if you've used 1.7, you're very familiar, specifically .NET, with WCF Data Services. This is your context, iQueryable, things like that. That's still there, and it's even better than ever. You get extra diagnostics and debugging information. But we've added a new thing that we're calling this table service layer, and there's a couple different ways to work with it. If you're working with Windows 8 specifically, we have a core WinMB library that will expose just this dynamic table entity approach because you're not having generic queries come back. But if you're not in JavaScript using C Sharp, whatever, there's a table extension library that lights this up as well. So it's the same. In most cases, the code translates word for word from desktop to Windows 8, which is great. Anyway, so dynamic table entity, this is just a property bag. There's a key, here's a value, and it's been deserialized to a given type. So double, GUID, whatever it is. This is great when you don't know the schema, especially at compile time, right? If you don't know what data you have to insert, what you're going to get back. Option three, we have POCOs. So very similar to Davis Service context. You just have a table entity, and you derive anything, and you expose a property. As long as it's public, gettable, and settable, we'll serialize it for you. The cool thing here, a couple high points. You get to control the serialization if you want to. And this really helps with heterogeneous entities and a bunch of different things, different scenarios that can help you with perf. But also, the e-tag is maintained on the entity itself. So you don't have this third party involved that's tracking your objects. It's not some long-lived thing that's, you know, have to worry about GC and whatnot. So it's very easy to update. For our example, we're going to use just a variety of these different approaches, 2 and 3. And we'll talk about the performance. I'm running out of time here, so I've got to hurry up here. But we see dramatic, dramatic improvements. So now here's our workflow. Device asks the service for walls. Once the user selects a wall, we join it. And the graffiti service is going to issue those SAS tokens. Now, the device is going to start writing, but also upsert that dirty periodically so that we can schedule that we've written some data. When the user draws, device caches it in this lazy pump. All is sent up as a batch request to wall table. That's great. So let's just look at some code. A couple things here. So here's our service. We're just using a really simple in-memory cache. But this is just join game. And you're going to send me, right now, it could be a game identifier GUID. You're going to send me the PKRK for now and your user ID. I leave it to you to do open auth or whatever sort of thing to do permissions if you care. But here's the important thing. So for these people right here, I want to give them access to this one wall table. And I want them to do it for the game start time and end time. Now, I've chosen 5 minutes just on the edge cases for clock skew that Jay just talked about. And I only want them to add records, right? It would be really bad if one client could go in there and just wipe out all the data. That wouldn't be good. And then secondly, I have a different policy that's just one central dirty wall for everybody. And I want to give them very restricted permissions as well. So we have this add or update. Update's needed for the upsert. But here's the cool part. So right here on this signature, I want you to be able to add a shape to a table, but I don't want you to add just anything. And in fact, I've actually taken semantic dependencies in my code on the ordering of data. So now I know that I'll have a checkpoint record, but I'll also have shapes right under it. If you could insert a whole bunch of crud in the middle of that, that would hurt my performance. So I'm going to limit you to a given partition key, start and end range, and a given row key start and end range. So in this case, we have our coordinates 0 to 999 for all three dimensions and a given shape. Right? So this means you can see that we end with the curly bracket there. So whatever entity it starts, the row key has to start with shape underscore. And then we have the same thing for SAS. And we're going to say right now the table name is the row key of the given wall. So you can only insert it on that specific row key and on these different partition keys. So that's great. Now I want to go to how we draw shapes. Now a couple things. The new table service layer is very, very easy to work with. It isn't a full iQueryable. It's a request that's coming. One of the things that's really cool about it, though, is it looks very similar across different platforms, and it's very, very performant. So right here, you can see the async, sort of Windows 8 app. In .NET 4.0 for desktop, you'll see the APM and sync, and we'll be exposing task in the future as well. So here's a way that I can just execute a batch. The cool thing we want to show you here is we have this new thing called opContext, and this gives you a whole bunch of information about what was done for you and what happened when something executed. So now I can get service request IDs if I need to, you know, have support, or I can get information about when different messages are starting and ending. So this is great for parallel uploads, right, if I wanted to track progress or something. The other cool thing we have here is client trace ID. So this is something, again, in our scenario, our users are writing straight to storage. And in some cases, that gives me a little less control because I can't, you know, figure out who did what right away. But with analytics and with this ability to specify custom trace IDs, now you have a pre-built end-to-end logging system out of the box where I can have my client set trace IDs for given operations, and then I can go through in my logs in the back end and figure out who did what, who deleted my container, who added what, and some other cool metrics scenarios. We'll get to those too. So great. We'll run this real quick. Actually, we are still running, so we'll just draw some shapes, which is great. And the fiddler's going. All right, so you saw my lazy pump, entity pump just upload stuff. You can see, okay, here's my user ID. I uploaded three things. And that's now going to show up in my logging at the end of the day so that I can trace who did what to what resource. Okay, so the other cool thing that was somewhat more difficult, let's say, in previous SDKs, is we have this great schema-less data store in the back end, which is really cool. You can store different type of entities side by side. You can do really cool things in batching in an atomic way, things like customer orders and different things like that. But sometimes it was hard to express those on the client side, especially when you had these client objects that did deserialization for you. You ended up having to read and write XML and do different things like that. So we wanted to make that truly just a first-class citizen. So I'm going to show you just some of the extensibility. All right, so we have this new concept that's an optional thing called a resolver. And a resolver is something you can specify that literally the data as it comes off the wire, not in three different incarnations of the data that you can use, but literally the data as we got it off the wire, you can decide what to do with it. Right? And so you can see here, I have a partition key, a row key, a timestamp, a properties, which is my dictionary, name value pair, and then an e-tag. And these are all defined in a given interface. But the cool thing about this, it lets me make a decision of how to let the storage client deserialize this data for me, right? So in this case, I'm going to check and say, OK, I'm deserializing all sorts of different entity types. And I can show you those, some of those right here. We wanted to have derived entity types. So we have a base shape, and it has a shape type and position and stroke and color and all those things that are common. But some of these things have unique properties. This guy has width and height. A line has an endpoint, for example. But I don't want to have to maintain all that myself. And if somebody renames something or updates it or whatever, I don't want to have to rewrite all my serialization logic. So going back to this guy, all I have to do is choose some sort of return type. Now, in this case, we're a WCF server, so we're actually going to project these into a different DTO object and send them over. But we can choose how these guys are deserialized. So in this case, we're just going to directly do it via the hash map. In other cases, what we could do is just call read entity directly. So if we look at this worker thread, this is what this shortened code is. So I'm going to return a table entity. All I have to do is instantiate it, and then I can let its built-in deserialization logic take over. So now, at the end of the day, I can do a query against some base type. And all I have to do at runtime, this will just choose the correct entity type, rectangle, ellipse, line, or a checkpoint. And then it'll set these basic properties. And once you call read, everything's populated for you. So now you end up with a list of different type of entities. You don't have to do any of XML or anything out of the box. This is the thing that really lets your data dance. You can make stuff go upside down, backwards. You can concatenate stuff, do a lot of different things. Other cool thing we want to show you is that since you now have control over the serialization, you could do some different cool scenarios. So in our example, we had a checkpoint record, which was effectively an image. But this image was very short-lived, 5 seconds, 3 seconds, right? So it didn't quite make sense to stick it in a CDN as a blob. But because it's so small, we can actually stick it in a row in a table, right? Because that'll support up to a meg. Our issue was a given property stops at 64K. And so sometimes images get a little bit above or below or whatever. But we want to have more bytes in that. So by extending this, what we did is we exposed this one property, bytes, and we just implement the overrides for read and write entity. So now basically what this lets me do, read entity, you get that same property similar to resolver, and I can go through here. And basically what this is going to do is take a whole bunch of different properties and reassemble them when I read. And when I write, it's going to split my data up into bytes underscore 00, bytes underscore 11. And now I effectively have an entity that can go up to a meg, and I don't have to worry about any of that gunk underneath. You can do a lot of really cool things with this interface. Again, it's optional. It depends on the shape of your data.
Yeah. You want to skip this thing?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So yeah, we're running out of time, so we'll try to put a bunch of this at the end. Something we did a lot is focus on fundamentals in addition to expanding platform support. So this is a chart we're really excited about. This is one of the stress scenarios we had. You can see the previous SDK. We have deletes, queries, inserts. This specific one is for batch. If you use the table service layer, literally, not only do you execute 4 times faster, but we've reduced CPU levels and memory resources dramatically over that same same reduction. In some cases, we'll get to some different numbers about query, insert, delete. You're seeing anywhere from 20 all the way up to 80, 90% reduction in latency. And on top of this, we were talking about cost specifically for scale apps and apps that might be ad supported and things like that. If you use a third or a fourth less of the CPU you used to, you need less workers. You can do more stuff. So this helps you drive down cost. We've put a lot of work into this. The other cool thing that we've invested in is some commonization of code assets. So the WinPhone library that will be coming out soon is largely the same thing that you can get in the cloud. The cool thing there is we run massive stress on this for weeks and weeks, and it's very solid and robust. On top of that, it lets us get features out faster. And the Windows 8 library, again, shares very much a lot of same common code as well. So this is with blobs. You can see we have upload, download. These are just latencies. On top of that, not only do we improve latencies, but we've actually reduced processor time pretty significantly, you can see over there, and then memory uses as well. We've got a bunch more work. We're going to keep making this better and better. So we're really excited for people to kind of adopt this and go forward. Just one quick thing on the client side. JSON is coming. That's going to be another thing that's really going to help us drive those latencies down. And then, if you have any more questions, you can come get me afterwards. And there's a little more demo. We'll make the code available so you can poke around, play with it.
Just to quickly cover the future features, as you mentioned, JSON for tables. So the OData team is working on a JSON Lite format, which reduces the gunk that is transferred with respect to AtomPub. We all understand that we're building applications that need to scale. You want to reduce the latency, and this is surely going to help us. So JSON for tables is one of the features that is high on our list. Cores support with all the mobile applications and stuff like that, and browser-based applications that you want to develop, core support becomes really critical for it. Content disposition is another request that we've got, kind of allowing the browsers to kind of tell how they should save this particular file. Queue batching, again, that's again for scale, increases your throughput. Provide geo failover control to the user so you can control it and test your applications on how it deals with geo failovers, and Windows Phone library that Joe mentioned. So these are our future features. Questions? Yes?
How will we get the code? You put it in your blog and then?
GitHub?
Yeah, so right now the desktop library has already gone out in the latest SDK. You can go directly to GitHub, Windows Azure, Azure SDK for Net. And that's actually pretty cool because it's the common code for both Windows 8 and desktop. So you can enlist there. And it's also available via NuGet. Windows 8 is available in a separate GitHub repo. We'll have a link up on the blog that you can download a zip file. But then that's also being put into an installer for VS as well. And then WinPhone is coming in the future weeks.
And if you're referring to the demo code, that'll be available through GitHub. Pardon? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the October
release. The
latest
release of the SDK.
The other thing really important is to check the Azure Storage blog. We put a whole bunch more details about the new table service layer, some of the breaking changes we might have, the performance improvements things. We'll go there, and also specific things about Windows 8. So.